On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A police raid on a bookstore in East Jerusalem, followed by the arrest of the owners, sends a clear message.
If these two can be arrested for simply selling books that have the word Palestine in them, then nobody is safe.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, the chilling implications for free speech in Israel. Also, a big artificial intelligence summit in France shows that nobody wants to be left out.
AI should serve the whole world and not just a small handful of private actors based in the US.
And in Senegal, street names are reminders of French colonial rule.
When you go out to big cities like Dakar, Saint-Louis at that time, they will choose French names in order to leave their imprint, their mark on those cities forever.
Plus, we meet rapper MC Sofia.
Ah, preguiçosa, coisa que...
All coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. Carolyn Beeler has a day off. We begin the show in Paris, where a high-stakes summit on artificial intelligence kicks off today. It brings together world leaders, tech executives, and scientists to focus on the implications of AI for societies, governments, and economies. And to be clear, global competition is a big theme. Just listen to French President Emmanuel Macron addressing those gathered for the summit this morning.
I have a good friend in the other part of the ocean saying, drill, baby, drill. Here, there is no need to drill. It's just plug, baby, plug. Electricity is available. You can plug. It's ready.
The tone is remarkable when you consider how recent global summits on AI tended to focus on oversight, the guardrails needed to prevent AI from infringing on rights or jeopardizing jobs and people's livelihoods. The mood at this summit suggests a shift. Nick Reiners is on the ground at the Paris AI Summit. He's a senior geotechnology analyst at Eurasia Group.
Macron, he was really trying to big up French AI and the possibility for AI to be built in Europe. And he said that companies in Europe should buy European and buy French. He talked about this 109 billion euro investment that he announced yesterday on TV. He says that's going to allow France to compete with the big U.S. tech companies and China's DeepSeek.
DeepSeek, of course, from China, cheap to make and quickly overtook rival AI models.
Indeed. Macron, he talked about how France has strong reserves of nuclear power, lots of cheap electricity, since energy is an important part of training AI. And they're really trying to broaden the conversation quite a lot and put the emphasis on the opportunities of AI rather than the risks, but also the societal aspects of AI that France believes have been neglected, thinking about, for example, the impact of AI on the future of work, the impact on the environment, and particularly on the creative sectors. And Macron, who was speaking just now, promised that AI in Europe would respect creators, you know, respect copyright.
So is France kind of in a position to be strutting its AI bona fides right now? And if so, what are those bona fides?
France has some top AI engineers. It has reserves of talent. You know, it has some great universities like Paris-Saclay, which has turned into this big AI hub. And it's produced, you know, famous AI engineers like Yann LeCun, who's Meta's top AI guy. And of course, then you have Mistral AI, which is France's and Europe's most famous and most talented AI company that's put out some models that compare fairly well to some of the models put out by the big US firms and now DeepSeek. So of all European countries, France is probably the one with the most AI bona fides.
Is it realistic, do you think, Nick, for European countries to think they can catch up to the US and China? And if so, what does that look like?
They can be in the game. I don't think France or the EU is ever necessarily going to be able to compete quite at the same level as the US. But, you know, DeepSeek has shown that actually it's possible to adopt a kind of fast follow strategy. It's a demonstration that without access to necessarily hundreds of thousands of top NVIDIA chips and hundreds of billions of dollars, it's possible to make a pretty good AI model that performs at pretty much the same level. France is determined to stay in the AI race. So there's this kind of attitude that Europe needs to get its technological sovereignty back and not be dependent on the US.
And in those conversations, are you hearing ways that Europe might be thinking about how to do that?
Well, a big part of it is money, including, I think, a 30 billion euro investment from the Gulf. So they're getting the Gulf states involved, the UAE. Another ingredient is talent. Europe does have AI talent. And then the third part is data. Maybe they will struggle there because in the EU, there are strict rules over how you can use data. So maybe that's the missing piece of the puzzle at this stage.
If you wouldn't mind, Nick, spin up the positive side of what the attendees at this Paris AI summit are talking about. Where are hopes kind of focused in the future?
I think a big part of the conversation is about the idea that AI should serve the whole world and not just a small handful of private actors based in the US. It will involve some public funding, but it's also about, you know, making sure that AI can be used to solve real problems like alleviate hunger and disease and so on. So there's a model for it in the form of what's called digital public infrastructure, which is big in some countries like India. India is probably the biggest example, which has built what it calls the India Stack, which is to have sovereign technological infrastructure. So it's kind of building on this idea, taking the power back from Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and these kind of folks and redistributing it. It's a bit unclear how you can actually deliver that necessarily, but I would say that's where the buzz is.
So at the summit in Paris, you've got tech companies and global leaders together. Where are their goals overlapping and where are they in competition with each other?
I think that the French have taken a very pro-innovation perspective to this conference. And Macron, who was speaking just now, he was promising to simplify some of the EU's AI rulebooks. So there's an overlap in terms of their attitude to regulation. Both the French government and the tech companies think that the EU has gone too far in regulating tech companies, especially when it comes to AI. So there's a kind of overlap. Where there's a tension is particularly when it comes to the US companies. As I said, there's this real feeling of we need to take the power back from the big US AI companies. So that's where there's a sort of power struggle going on, I think.
Nick Reiners is a senior geotechnology analyst at Eurasia Group. He spoke to us from the AI Global Summit in Paris. Next weekend, the future of the war in Ukraine will be top of mind at the Munich Security Conference, where a top advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the Ukrainian delegation will present its position on ending the war. Ukraine is pushing for security guarantees to prevent future aggression from Russia. Top officials from the Trump administration will also be at the summit. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz told NBC yesterday that the U.S. is prepared to pressure Moscow to get Putin to the negotiating table. Waltz also said Europe needs to step up its support for Ukraine, adding that the U.S. might consider using Ukrainian natural resources to recoup the cost of war. Inside Ukraine, the fighting is not letting up. Funerals for soldiers are common in cities and towns. The official death toll is a closely guarded secret, but according to current estimates, some 100,000 Ukrainians have died as a result of the conflict. Reporter Emily Johnson in Kyiv has this story about how Ukrainians are reviving old traditions for funerals, especially the music.
It's a sunny day, and two hearses lead a procession through Lviv's cobblestone central plaza, known as Market Square. Outside the town hall, a musician in a red uniform is waiting for them, with his head bowed and a trumpet in his hand. Mourners and passers-by sink to their knees. Many are in uniform. Two soldiers are being laid to rest today, Yuri Teodor Suznivsky and Dmytro Manayev. Both are sons of this city. Yaroslav Simky is playing a song commonly mistaken for taps, but it's an Italian melody called Il Silenzio by Nini Rosso. Once, his job was simply to play at certain times of day, from a window high up in the town hall. But he's been playing funeral processions here in the square since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. At first, it was about four times a week, but these days, his only day off is Sunday, and he's sometimes asked to play twice in a day. He says it hasn't gotten easier with time. You don't get used to it, he says. For Simky, playing the song isn't the hard part. It is very difficult to live through this, he says. It's not difficult to play. And they are young people who would have been the future of Ukraine. He's no stranger to playing at military funerals. He served for 20 years playing in the military orchestra here in Lviv during the Soviet era. Ukrainian music was forbidden at funerals during the war in Afghanistan in the 70s. They'd play the Soviet national anthem, and a salute would be fired. I meet Ludmila Ivanikova at a church in Kyiv, where a number of folk musicians have gathered to play after the service. She wears a scarf over her hair, as is customary for women in a place of worship. Ivanikova is a folklorist who studied Ukrainian music traditions for 40 years. She says they've served as an important through line throughout its troubled history. She says some distinctly Ukrainian musical traditions have revived in recent years as people have mourned loved ones lost to Russian aggression. Traditions like the Holosinya, a folk lament. In the 80s and 90s, the Holosinya was starting to fade in the villages, she says. But what struck me when the war broke out in 2014, she says, when they started bringing dead soldiers back from Donbass, then the people's lamentations began to revive en masse. Another folk tradition having a resurgence is the music of the Kobzars. As far back as the 16th century, they were wandering bards who played a variety of uniquely Ukrainian instruments, like the 12-stringed Kobza and the Bandura, which can have dozens of strings. It's only recently that modern-day Kobzars are being asked to play at funerals. They often play songs known as Dumi, epic poems that tell of Ukrainian history and past battles. These songs have a very archaic, deep character, she says, and they touch the most subtle, deepest aspects of the human soul and the Ukrainian soul. Vitaly Kobzar, whose last name is a happy coincidence for a Ukrainian musician, plays an example of a duma. The instrument in his hands is one he made himself out of willow. He says it took him 1 year, 6 months, and 22 days to complete it. When the Soviet Union was here, they started using brass bands at funerals, he says. But Ukrainian funerals never had anything like that before. We need to return to our own musical traditions. Outside the church, the small crowd that's gathered to hear the music buzzes with excitement. One of the musicians playing today is Taras Kompanichenko, Kobzar, Bandura player, leader of the band Karaya Kozatska, and junior sergeant in the armed forces. Kompanichenko is in uniform as he plays. He plucks the strings with fingernails that have been lacquered into picks. In this piece, he sings of a young woman waiting for her love and of the sound of howling guns and of drones. He joined the military in February 2022, days after the invasion.
Kobzar I досі.
The Kobzar is still a mythological figure in Ukrainian culture, he says. We want Kobzars to fulfill the same functions that they did in ancient Ukrainian culture, to awaken people's dignity, knowledge of Ukrainian history, admiration, interest, and universal values. Kompanichenko was born and raised here in Kyiv, and playing folk instruments was rare enough that his classmates laughed at him for choosing the bandura over something like guitar. But his decision proved to be a prescient one. I play at funerals not only in times of war, he says. It was already one of my services. But the culture of Ukrainian burial is just as important as the culture of Ukrainian weddings, as the culture of Ukrainian baptisms. That is, the arrival of a person into the world and the departure of a person. Since becoming a soldier, he says, he's played many funerals, including for men in his own brigade. Someone said, we never thought that these songs, these historical songs, would be about us, he says. And these songs are about us. For The World, I'm Emily Johnson, Kyiv, Ukraine.
The Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania severed ties to Russia's energy grid over the weekend. The Soviet-era transmission lines connecting them to Russia, Belarus, and Kaliningrad were ceremonially turned off one by one. It was a big deal. A giant digital clock in the Lithuanian capital Vilnius counted down to the shutdown. When the clock reached zero and the countries joined the Western European power grid, there was a big celebration. EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen was in attendance to mark the energy transition, which has been in the works for 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Once upon a time, and we're talking medieval times, Arab rulers collected tents. These were a far cry, though, from your campground variety tent, a sleeping bag not included. These tents were intricately designed, made of silk, and embroidered with gold and set with jewels. They were basically portable palaces, symbols of wealth, power, and beauty throughout the Islamic world. Odd then to find one in a fresco on the wall of a convent in Ferrara, Italy. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains the recent discovery.
The fresco isn't easy to make out. It's been covered up over the years by pictures of Jesus and the Virgin Mary. But it's there, says Frederica Gigante, a historian at Cambridge University.
So when you come in, you are faced with three alcoves at the back of the church.
At one time, she says, it would have been like you're standing in an elaborate tent with blue and gold silk falling around you.
It really gives the illusion of being a real textile because it's painted with all its folds and fringes, and it's as if it was literally hanging around the three walls.
Along the bottom, there's a border decorated with pseudo-Arabic script. Gigante has a theory about what it's doing there, and she published it in an art journal this month. She believes there was once a real Islamic royal tent hanging here in the church, covering the altar. Perhaps it was only brought out on special occasions, and the fresco would have reminded congregants of its splendor. Gigante thinks this tent might have originally belonged to the Muslim ruler of Spain, the Caliph Mohammed el-Nasser, and was seized during the wars between Christians and Muslims for control of the Iberian Peninsula in the 13th century.
It was taken from the Caliph and shipped to the Pope in Rome as a gift.
And then possibly shipped to Ferrara. Even though an Islamic tent in a Benedictine convent might seem weird to us, it wouldn't have to Christians in the Middle Ages. Arab textiles and Arabic scripts were all over the place in churches and in paintings of the Nativity, says Charles Burnett. He's a historian at the University of London.
It is quite common for Arabic inscriptions or pseudo-Arabic on the garments, especially of the Virgin Mary. And you can recognize sometimes verses from the Quran, and certainly holy verses, featuring prominently in these inscriptions on the hems.
He says Islamic textile in the minds of Christians at the time was associated with the Holy Land in the time of Christ. There is this misconception that because the Holy Land in the 13th century produced lavish textiles, and people spoke Arabic, and it was ruled by Muslim rulers, the same must have been true in the time of Christ.
Especially in nativity scenes, the Arabic is simply there to invoke the Middle East.
There's another reason, says Frederica Gigante. These textiles are beautiful, really the finest in the world. What better to adorn the Virgin or cover the altar?
Not only textiles, but in general, Islamic art at the time was so much appreciated for its incredible quality. It was a given, and Christians were really ready to incorporate it, even in churches.
It's a good reminder, says Gigante, of cross-cultural exchange. We tend to think of Christians and Muslims in this period as in conflict, and they were. But the reality is far more complicated and interesting. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Senegal in West Africa gained its independence from France in 1960. That was 65 years ago, but even today, the reminders of French colonial rule are everywhere. Street names are one very present artifact of that history, and that's about to change. It's part of a larger effort by Senegal to look at its own history and identity without the filter of the French perspective. Azil Momar Lo is a journalist with AfricaCheck.org in Senegal's capital, Dakar.
It started a few years back when we were still under the reign of former President Macky Sall, who initiated some thoughts about renaming some streets in downtown Dakar, because so far so many streets in downtown Dakar have been named after French colonialists. There's even a 2019 study which shows that right now in downtown Dakar, up to 60% of the streets are bearing names of former colonial leaders or rulers from France. Mm. There is one famous street, which is called Avenue Federpe, named after one of the most famous colonial rulers from France.
So this colonial governor, Federpe, what is it exactly that he's remembered for, and why specifically would that street name want changing?
Federpe is somebody who reminds people of a very painful past, because he's been accused of torturing local heroes who would fight against the French colonial army in order to get independence. Mm. So when you think about people like Federpe, you will think about very painful artifacts and remembrances.
So Azil, tell us about some of the prominent Senegalese people whose names could be added to street signs.
People like Ladjo, Lajo is one of the rare Senegalese heroes who stood up to fight against the colonial French army in Senegal. He even defeated them in many, many battles in the 1800s.
1800s, gotcha.
Ultimately, he ended up being killed by the French colonial army. But Lajo is one of the rare military figures who stood up to fight against the French colonial army here in Senegal.
Well, there are also political and cultural figures that street names might consider. For example, Leopold Sédar Senghor, the first president, or Youssou N'Dour.
Exactly, Youssou N'Dour, or even Aline Sitoé Diatta, a female political leader and fighter, which was rare at that time because you would rarely see a woman who would lead some important movement made up of women and men to stand up against the colonial administration. So she was a really political activist at that time.
I'm curious, Azil, how unanimous is this desire, let's say in Dakar, to change the street names? Are there people who are opposed, and why are they?
Right. I got the chance to go down in the street and meet the really Senegalese population inside markets. So, you know, in very popular zones. But most people would think this is a very welcome decision to rename all these streets with our local hero. That's what you would hear from the majority. However, you would come across one or two people who would say, hey, look, this is a very good thing, but the priority is for us to have good living conditions first. If we have that, then you can come up with a project to rename the streets. So most people would think it is a very good thing, but others will tell you it's not a priority.
I ask partly because Senegal, I also think of Côte d'Ivoire, countries that were deeply, and one might even say proudly, in the sphere of French influence. I mean, the first president of Senegal, Senghor, was a poet, wrote in French, and famously became the first African to be part of the vaunted Académie Française, overseeing the rules of the language. So removing the French legacy from Senegalese identity seems complicated on many levels.
It's not an easy thing at all. It's not a piece of cake, especially, as you said, when you look at the so many remnants and artifacts from France that we still have here. However, activists, some analysts will tell you that it all starts with one step. And it shouldn't be, in the long run, a difficult thing to do, because this whole new generation of political leaders in Senegal, they really want to break away with anything having to do with France when it comes and makes you see things in a less balanced relationship. So they really want to see Senegal as an equal to France.
That was journalist Azil Momar Lo speaking about the importance of street names in Dakar, Senegal. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brazilian rapper MC Sofia is riding a wave of success after wrapping her first U.S. tour, but the 20-year-old is no stranger to the global spotlight. She performed at the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio when she was just 12 years old and stole the show. At the time, she'd already been making music for years. Now, as a young adult, MC Sofia is on a mission to empower black women, starting with her own family. Reporter Gisele Rigatao caught up with her in Sao Paulo.
There are three generations of women behind MC Sofia. Her mom is her manager. Her grandmother does her PR. Who is the boss?
Eu que sou. A minha mãe acompanha.
I'm the boss, MC Sofia says. Her confidence is clear in many of her songs, which she writes herself. And she has no qualms about performing on the spot.
Eu tô bem, bem, bem. Eu tô bem sofisticada. Eu quero bens, bens, bens. Eu sou uma mulher cara.
Sofisticada, or Sophisticated, is the title track of her new album coming out in March. The song is about a black woman who is beautiful, sexy, who likes expensive things and is dissing a man. Her lyrics are about empowering black women, either as sexual beings or having money. Both her mother and grandmother have college degrees, and she says they taught her to be proud of her race. So when I started singing, it was not like I decided that I was going to talk about empowering women. The subject was just natural for me, she says. Her mother, Camila Pimentel, had MC Sofia when she was 18. For years, the two lived with Pimentel's mother at a housing project in the outskirts of São Paulo. MC Sofia always wanted to be a singer, Her mother was the one who took her to hip-hop workshops when she was 6 years old. And her mom has managed her career ever since. Sometimes the roles get confusing, Pimentel says, because she has a strong personality and I do as well. So sometimes I'm scolding her and I don't know if I'm doing it as a manager or as a mother. Sofia quickly jumps in.
Ela vai num assuntos muito familiares, não é de empresária.
It's definitely as a mother, because sometimes she says things that a manager wouldn't, like she calls me lazy, she says. It's hard to imagine MC Sofia being lazy. She, her mom, and grandmother do everything themselves. Manage her label, catalog, book concerts, and create social media posts. Just last month, MC Sofia released an EP with the Canadian DJ duo Goldap. I'm crazy, booty booty to the ground, Writer Kawan Ferreira has been following MC Sofia's work since 2015, when she was 11 years old. She was singing about playing with dolls, he says, but it was a black doll. So she was talking about the reality of black children, which generated media interest as well. MC Sofia's songs are often used in schools in Brazil. And Ferreira says she's also a role model for the LGBTQ community. A few years ago, she came out as bisexual. But he says, ultimately, it's her music that stands out. Aniversário, or birthday, is one of her best songs, in my opinion, he says, because she talks about her power without taking other people down.
Não é comum aqui hoje no Brasil uma mulher fazendo sucesso no hip hop, né?
It's not common today in Brazil for a woman to be successful in hip hop, says Matheus Ramos. He writes about culture and entertainment for the website Notícia Preta, which caters to black people in Brazil.
Ela sabe que ela é uma vitrine do público dela para as meninas da periferia.
She knows she's a showcase for black women who live in the inner cities and in the favelas. She's a pillar, a role model, he says. MC Sofia acknowledges she's pretty well known, but she doesn't consider herself famous yet.
Eu tô querendo focar nesse meu álbum, focar nas minhas músicas e...
I want to focus on this new album, on my songs, she says. She feels her career can still blow up even bigger. Não tem nada, não tem nada. Chegou verão, hoje eu vou sair. Chama as amigas pra me divertir. Não tem nada pra me impedir. Não tem nada, não tem nada. The goal is to be so famous that she will get to work with some of her idols, Nicki Minaj and Beyoncé. For the world, I'm Gisele Regatão, São Paulo, Brazil.
Over the weekend, Israeli police raided a well-known bookstore in East Jerusalem. It's an intellectual hub called the Educational Bookshop. The owners, Mahmoud Muna and his nephew Ahmed, were arrested on suspicion of violating public order. They appeared in a Jerusalem court today, while outside, people gathered to show support for the two men. That included Jerusalem-based writer Nathan Thrall. His book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, won a Pulitzer Prize for its gripping descriptions of life in the West Bank. When the book was published, Thrall told us today he had a launch party at the Educational Bookshop.
It's a place that diplomats, journalists, and all kinds of people from all over the world go to. They know Mahmoud Muna and Ahmed. You know, this was a blow against two of the most prominent figures in East Jerusalem that really sent a message to all Palestinians that if these two can be arrested for simply selling books that have the word Palestine in them, then nobody is safe.
As I said, you had the publication Liftoff at the Educational Bookshop. Why was it important for you to do it there? What does that say?
It's a place I love. It's a wonderful bookstore. Mahmoud and Ahmed are wonderful people. For many years, my wife would always force me to get rid of books. I buy too many, and she forces me to cull them every now and again. And I would give them to Mahmoud and Ahmed, to the educational bookstore, and they would then donate them to a library in Gaza. And it's, you know, a leading cultural institution in East Jerusalem. So it was fitting that I did the launch of the book with them. And I tried with Mahmoud to get a permit for the protagonist, the title character of my nonfiction book, Abd Salama, who grew up in Jerusalem. And he lives on the other side of the wall, 10 minutes from the launch event for the book. And all of the requests for him to get a permit to come and speak to this audience were denied. So instead, I read a statement from him about how he was prevented from coming to the city that he was raised in to speak to a large crowd of Jews and Palestinians and internationals about his own life, and how the very fact that he was deprived of coming 10 minutes away on the other side of the wall to this room was exactly what this book is about.
So the owners were arrested, I understand, on charges of disrupting public order. Critics are saying that they've really been arrested for amplifying Palestinian culture. What is your take on what's happened and why?
Well, there is no plausibility to the claim that bookstore was disturbing public order. This is a bookstore that has existed for many, many years, and all they were doing was selling books as they have always done. The Israeli police, when they put out a press release about the arrest, showed a coloring book in English that said "From the River to the Sea" on it. And this government of Israel, its guidelines explicitly state that there shall only be Jewish sovereignty from the river to the sea. So to claim that these people are disturbing the peace by selling books that they have always sold is absurd.
Yeah, I mean, "From the River to the Sea," as listeners will remember, has become kind of a controversial statement for both sides.
But only controversial when Palestinians say it, because, as I say, it's the policy of the Israeli government. And it's never controversial when they say there shall only be a single Jewish sovereign from the river to the sea.
I mean, I'm also wondering what it says about just free expression in general for people in Israel. Even with this authoritarian wall that the prime minister has built around his power, there's a sense at least that there's free expression still. What's your take on that?
Yes, there is a feeling that there is free expression for Israeli Jews, even Palestinian citizens of Israel. They face a different standard, and they have been arrested for Facebook posts and Facebook and Instagram likes over the last 15 months.
It is telling that among the supporters of the bookstore are both Arabs and Jews in Jerusalem. If the shop were to be closed permanently, what would that mean for efforts at coexistence?
The closure of the bookshop would be one of many travesties in East Jerusalem. And, you know, I think before we think about coexistence, we need to think about Palestinian existence. And that's what's really under threat here.
Nathan Thrall is an author based in Jerusalem. His latest book is A Day in the Life of Abd Salama. In Japan, an indigenous community known as the Ainu has been struggling to assert a 21st century identity after decades of erasure. Under Japanese assimilation laws, the Ainu people at one point had to abandon their cultural practices and hunting and fishing traditions. Then, about 20 years ago, the Japanese government officially recognized the group as indigenous, and ever since, remaining members of the Ainu community have been trying to reclaim their heritage amid internal tension. Some want to revive the past, others want to build something new. Reporter Rebecca Rossman brings us a story from Japan, starting in an artist studio in the town of Nibutani.
When I meet Toru Kaizawa, he's chiseling the outstretched wings of an owl sculpture. He's using the weight of his knees to hold the sculpture in place while he perfects the details. Kaizawa comes from a long line of Ainu craftsmen, but one of his most famous pieces is in the British Museum. It's called Identity.
Fastener を下げてこういう状態っていうのは皆さんと同じ外観は変わらないんですよ。
It's a sculpture of a modern-looking jacket, half unzipped, to reveal a traditional pattern dress in neutral colors of sand and cream. Kaizawa says the modern jacket and traditional pattern represent a choice that he and his friends had to make growing up. If we pulled the zipper all the way up, we looked no different than anyone else, and we were Japanese, he says. But if we wanted to be able to show other people our Ainu heritage too, then we had to pull the zipper down. Until recently, those who pulled the zipper down in public were taking a risk. To understand why, you have to go back to 1869, when Japan annexed the island that was home to around 15,000 native Ainu and renamed it Hokkaido. A strict assimilation policy forced the Ainu to give up not just their land, but also their traditions and language, which was passed down orally.
Paroho.
Paroho.
Kisaraha.
Kisaraha.
Nupuri.
Nupuri.
This recording of basic words can be heard at the Ainu Culture Museum, which houses around 900 artifacts.
Ni.
Ni.
Nonno.
Nonno.
For centuries, the Ainu lived by rivers and streams, catching salmon and hunting deer for their livelihoods. That, too, changed when Japan confiscated Ainu land. River fishing and bow hunting became illegal, forcing many into menial jobs. Ancestral traditions were stripped away, forgotten. Fast forward to 2008, when Japan's parliament passed a resolution recognizing the Ainu as a, quote, indigenous people, with a distinct language, religion, and culture. When the resolution became law a decade later, many saw an invitation to restore the culture that had been lost. But that's been a bumpy ride. Hiromasa Sashima heads the Rapporo Ainu Nation, a group that is suing the Japanese government to win back the right to fish for salmon in local rivers. He takes me out on his boat in the Tokachi River late one evening and shows me his latest catch, dozens of pounds of fresh snails. But what Sashima really wants is the right to catch salmon, just like his ancestors did for hundreds of years. Commercial fishing for salmon in rivers has been banned throughout Japan for over a century. Last year, a court ruled against Rapporo Ainu Nation's claim that it had an indigenous right to catch salmon in these rivers. The court argued that since Japan's fishing regulations apply equally to all citizens, the Ainu cannot be granted an exception. But Sashima says he is working on an appeal. The Rapporo Ainu Nation cites the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which says indigenous groups have a right to use their traditional lands.
Ainu の失われた権利っていうんですか?そういったのをこの鮭だけじゃなく。
The case isn't just about salmon fishing, Sashima tells me. It's about the idea that Hokkaido used to be home to the Ainu. And with this case, we want to take back some of the rights we used to have. He says the case also helped him forge a relationship with his Ainu roots. He shows me a video from last September. In it, Sashima is part of a group of people dressed in traditional Ainu robes and bandanas and waving swords in the air, part of an old ritual dance to welcome the salmon harvest. Sashima says they only started performing these dances again a few years ago. They asked elders living nearby for help with the steps. The moves are probably not 100% accurate, but Sashima says it's important to him to restore tradition as accurately as possible. Toru Kaizawa, the wood craftsman, says he respects those who want to restore tradition, but he also sees the future as an opportunity to move the culture forward.
Ainu no tenrankai っていうと、先人が作った古い民具が展示されてた。
He says when he was in his 30s, he had an epiphany about all this. He started looking at Ainu pieces in museums, and everything on the displays looked very similar. He thought to himself, it feels like Ainu culture has stopped. This is the final point where everything is the same now. Kaizawa says that idea started to wear on him. That's why today he believes Ainu culture doesn't need to be exactly what it once was.
で、それがいいと思っても作ってたんだけど、なぜか、なんかアイヌ文化がそこで止まってる、作ってるものが止まってるっていう。
It should be able to grow into something new, he says. He sees his work as a bridge between the past and the future, blending the old and the new, one chisel at a time. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Nibutani, Japan.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yesterday was round one of presidential elections in Ecuador, with concerns over crime and drug trafficking on many voters' minds. Of 16 candidates on the ballot, there were two clear favorites, conservative incumbent Daniel Noboa and leftist lawyer Luisa Gonzalez. The two main contenders walked away with roughly 44% of the votes each. Noboa and Gonzalez will now compete in a runoff election on April 13th. That will be a rematch. The two first ran against each other in a snap election in 2023, which brought Noboa his current 16-month term. In April, they will compete for a full presidential term, putting the winner in office for the next 4 years. Let's stay in Latin America with a story that takes us to Costa Rica now, a country with a population of just over 5 million people. In 2023, 2.5 million tourists showed up. A lot of them came to see wild sloths, toucans, monkeys, and sea turtles in a place largely considered to be a wildlife preservation success story. On the other hand, all those tourists, combined with urban development, that's not a recipe for success for wild animals. Jamie Fullerton took a tour with a group of conservationists to find out more.
They use the bathroom about every 5 to 7 days. They go down on the ground, they use their bums to do a little poop dance, and then they use the bathroom on the ground before they go back up another tree.
I'm on a guided tour in a wild animal sanctuary on Costa Rica's Caribbean coast. I'm learning a lot about sloths.
Wild, where they have that kind of green color to them, that algae, that moss, that bacteria, and yes, parasites. Everyone thinks that sloths are super cute and cuddly. Sloths are dangerous and disgusting.
With its sloth-filled forests and turtle-friendly beaches, Costa Rica is known as a shining example of ecotourism done well. The small Central American country has strong wildlife protection laws, and over the past 30 years, managed the rare feat of reversing deforestation. But recently, there have been signs of new dangers for wildlife.
And last year, exactly 1,001 animals arrived here to the center. Those numbers are slowly increasing each year, especially due to deforestation and urbanization.
Many conservationists in Costa Rica believe that wild animals don't have enough protections from the effects of urban development and tourism. There are fears that deforestation is creeping back through illegal and legitimate development. New roads and plantations have isolated wildlife habitats, and more animals are being killed by cars and electricity wires.
There's one?
There's one two-finger sloth there.
Two-finger sloth?
Yeah, you see in the pond?
I join a team from the Sloth Conservation Foundation, or SLOCO, near the small town of Puerto Viejo. On a patch of trees and grass between a beach and a hotel, we see two sloths high up in a tree.
He's there. He's sleeping now there. So there are two of them.
The SLOCO guys are putting up a green rope, about 100 feet long and 3 stories high, to connect to treetops. Sloths have tendons in their hands and feet that lock into place so they can easily climb along ropes. The SLOCO charity has put up hundreds of ropes around here. These sloth bridges are designed to help wild animals travel around habitats degraded by development.
Sloths are a great species for understanding the implications of development because they can't run, they can't jump, they can't fly.
Rebecca Cliff is a British zoologist and the founder of SLOCO.
In order to move from tree to tree, sloths need the branches and the canopy to physically overlap.
Rampant logging took place in Costa Rica in the 1950s and 60s, and by 1987, only around one-fifth of the country's land had forest cover. Logging restrictions were brought in, alongside financial compensation for farmers protecting forests. By 2021, around 60% of land in Costa Rica was covered by forest. However, in the last few decades, road construction has geared up across the country, and the government has encouraged tourism infrastructure.
As soon as you get any kind of development, the first thing that happens is that we start cutting down trees, and the sloths can no longer move around. They're coming down to the ground, they're getting hit by cars, attacked by dogs, electrocuted when they climb on power lines. And it's happening in astonishing numbers, like really terrifying numbers.
Development among forests also causes species isolation, This is when wildlife species have their habitats limited because a road, farm or structure creates barriers. In sloths, this causes problems such as lack of food and inbreeding. In Puerto Viejo, cars and ATVs chug along roads next to beach bars. The vehicles move under sloths perched in trees. Before coming here, in San Jose, I spoke with Alan Valverde, Dean of the University for International Cooperation's Faculty of Environment and Development.
At the beginning of the, for example, the creation of the Route 32, there was a scenario where you will find many animals dead. Big cats, raccoons, also anteaters, and many of those animals.
Valverde says that Route 32, a highway built in 1987, caused many animal deaths, and that species isolation wasn't properly considered in the road's planning. He says this is still a problem.
So what we are doing right now is to increase the size of the roads in order to have more lanes. This is one of the problems. But the other problem is that we don't create conditions to cross, like ecological bridges, to cross between one side to the other. So we are forgetting that.
The most stark example of the effects of species isolation here is the jaguar. This apex predator needs a huge amount of space to hunt, so forest fragmentation can be lethal for it. There are now believed to be only a few hundred jaguars in the wild in Costa Rica. A lack of jaguars can affect other species, such as peccaries, which are pig-like creatures the big cats eat.
The peccary is an omnivorous animal. If I not regulate this population, they will eat all the roots of the plants, they will eat many of the small animals, and they will change all the ecological of the ecosystem.
Valverde says there should be robust conservation certification requirements for tourism companies. He wants private forest owners to be given more incentives by the government for wildlife protection and for tourists to be better educated about minimizing their impact on habitats.
For me, Costa Rica is not a place for mass tourism. I understand that there's a huge tourist industry that depends on that and I can change it. For me, the answer is to try to promote tourism that understand the fragility of the ecosystem, the nature of our country, in the condition of biodiversity.
SLO co-founder Rebecca Cliff says Costa Rica should force developers in towns like Puerto Viejo to have wildlife and environmental assessments. She also says authorities should focus on attracting fewer, higher-spending tourists.
It's been fantastic for the economy. So many people are coming to Costa Rica now to see sloths primarily. But with that, you get this massive development, right? So now it's gone the other way. It's gone too far.
Costa Rica is expecting 2024 to be a record year for tourist numbers. With development not slowing, it seems like plenty more bridges need to be built to ensure that the country's reputation as a wildlife haven doesn't begin to fade. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Puerto Viejo, Costa Rica.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening as always. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Pat Castaldo, Catherine D., Jan Elizabeth, Chris Gillis, Rich Gorlick, Leanne Hahn, and Patrice F. and Cameron J. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.